Welcome to the Look Far podcast, Voices from the Wild. Join Look Far Conservation as we talk to conservation leaders from around the world about their work, their life, the challenges they face, and the successes they've had.
It was being able to say, I don't choose to be limited in this way, but I choose instead to be innovative. And our team chooses instead to look at what we're dealing with in front of us and say, how do we work with local people to protect this landscape? The way we do it is by meeting their need.
This week on the Look Far podcast, Micah Burhart joins us, founder and executive director of Legato, a fantastic nonprofit working in Africa that we will learn all about in the coming 45 minutes. Alex, you have been our producer and sort of fearless leader of the Look Far podcast through our first, I guess, 10 episodes. You're going to be leaving us, hopefully temporarily, to study abroad, but I just wanted to take a minute with you here before we got started to express my thanks and to wish you well on your little adventure that you have coming up.
Oh, thanks so much, Scott. I've had so much fun working with Look Far and starting this podcast with you and interviewing all of these people, even though I'm just kind of in the background listening. It's really been amazing to just hear all these cool stories.
Absolutely. And for those who don't know, Alex has painstakingly edited every episode, making everyone sound much better than they would normally, especially me. And you didn't have any background in this. You figured out how to edit and use complex software like Adobe Audition pretty much on the fly and got the hang of it almost right away.
Yeah, YouTube's a pretty incredible thing. It taught me basically everything. So I don't know, I wouldn't have figured any of it out without YouTube and Batsheva.
That's right. Batsheva Gez, our board member and filmmaker extraordinaire, who I know was able to tutor you a little bit. But really, I think the mark of any good internship, any good job, is when it comes time to leave, everyone you work with goes, oh no, how are we going to replace her? And that's the mode we're in right now. So awesome that you're going to, well, actually, where are you headed? What's next? Why don't you tell everybody?
Yeah, so in about 2 weeks, I will be headed off to Milan, Italy to study abroad for one semester. And then I will be back in December and ready to rejoin the Look Far team.
That's right. We're excited for it. We're looking forward to it. And in the meantime, any final wise words or reflections or impressions from your experience with the podcast so far?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's so many fantastic people around the world that are achieving incredible accomplishments, and many of them have just gone so widely unrecognized just based on how secluded they are. And I think that the stories that these individuals have curated through their careers of just doing good for the world, I mean, they're really just unparalleled. And I think at least our goal, mine and Scott's, when we first set out to start the podcast, was to shed some light on these stories and provide a platform where the general public could have access to the amazing work being achieved around the world and maybe even, I don't know, generate some hope in the process.
Awesome. Well, Alex, thanks. It's been a great pleasure working with you. There's many more adventures that lie ahead. But for now, I know it might be tough to do this, but enjoy hanging out in Milan all fall while studying and, you know, enjoying life.
Thank you. Yeah, I plan to. I'll try my best.
All right, speaking to someone living their fullest life, we should get to Micah, who really, I was blown away by how many different things she's done and is doing. Just incredible.
Yeah, I don't know. I think Micah is one of the coolest people I've ever had privilege of listening to. She's just so passionate about everything she's done, and the way she speaks about her work and her life, it just inspires me to do better and to do more. And I really think that she's going to have the same impact on our listeners.
For sure. For sure. All right. Well, let's get to it. Alex, thanks again, and we'll see you when you get back.
Thank you so much. Let's get to it.
Welcome to the Look Far podcast. I'm Scott Stone, the host, and joined again today by Barbara Merz of Pathfinder International. Barbara, so glad you could come back and do another one of these with us.
Such a pleasure. Thanks, Scott.
And today we're joined by Micah Burhart, who is the founder and executive director of Legato, an international NGO working to help secure thriving futures for people and the wild places they call home. Micah is also a professional climber and an ambassador with Patagonia. And Micah, you know, there's so many great things that you're up to. I'm so pleased you could make time to stop by and talk to us about it.
It's awesome to be here. I've been looking forward to it.
So why don't we dive right in? You know, where, I mean, your whole life, your work, you know, everything is so focused on the outdoors. Where did that start? You know, what kicked off this incredible passion for the environment and the wild?
I grew up in Minnesota, and I had a family that was all about being outside in any kind of weather and always being athletic. And I loved it. And being outside in some ways, it was my perfect salvation to an otherwise pretty busy life. Even as a young kid, I've always been pretty intense. I've always taken the things that I do seriously. And I think that there was this wonderful antidote of exploring the outdoors. And as I got older and older, it became more my priority. I mean, I was that kid who, when I was 6 years old at my first overnight camp, there was a rock climbing adventure day and I was first on the list. And I probably elbowed several other girls out of the way to make sure I was not only first on the list, but got to go climbing first. And, you know, growing up in ski racing and paddling and you name it, being the outdoors became my priority. And in fact, early on, it presented a little bit of a tension for me because I used to think that if I was spending time outside, I wasn't advancing the other parts of my life that I was passionate about, you know, academics or contributing to the world in a way that felt important to me. And so I really set out to make my career about melding all those things.
Yeah, because I noticed that in addition to your sort of athletic outdoor exploits, you are a published author, you're a filmmaker. You know, tell me kind of where is the intersection between, you know, outdoors and the arts that you found, you know, inspiring and that made you want to create and put stuff out there?
That is a great question. I've never thought about it that way. For me, expressing myself and storytelling was always something that came with my personality. And when I was in my mid-20s, I started writing essays and was quickly published by Climbing Magazine and got a column and became a senior contributing editor for them. And it really let me flourish as someone who could go and have these crazy adventures and then talk about them, but talk about them in a really human way. Like, I was never the person writing about how this amazing climb happened. I was the person writing about weird things about how you get injured six times, how when you get divorced, you split up your climbing gear down to every single carabiner and every single wired nut and how you manage that. And I think that that took me into a realm of being able to be on the elite track as a professional climber, but also being able to be human. And I think that that's the nucleus that I'm always trying to find, right? It's like, no matter what we're doing, I mean, with Legato, we're running a conservation, it's not even a conservation organization anymore. That's what we thought we were building. And then we realized that building that wasn't the right fit. And so we reinvented it and said, we need to be at the nucleus of where we can meet people human to human. And I think that that's, for me, where art happens.
Mm-hmm. And there's kind of, I mean, not to get too metaphysical too early here. I think we've only been going for a few minutes, but there's something kind of metaphorical about climbing and that approach you just described in terms of, you know, how you are grappling with things, you know, high ambition, high level of difficulty, but then this very kind of organically evolving way of responding to what's out there. And, you know, you can't climb except, you know, what's there. It you can't just make it any other way. And I think you're meeting, you know, the world, whether it's in art, whether it's with Legato, in that same kind of very practical, adaptive, innovative way.
Yeah, that sums it up so well, Scott, because that's one of the ways I've been explaining what we do at Legato recently, because when you climb and when you're running expeditions around the world, if you're on a 50-foot climb or if you're on a 5-week expedition, you're solving for what's in front of you. And you don't limit yourself to a certain skill set, or you don't limit yourself to, you know, one avenue to pursue success, and nor do you limit yourself to one version of success. Like, you're constantly adapting. And I think that that has been my background for so long, that that's what I took into building this business. And that's, I think, what gives myself and then the team that we built this special energy, because it's this idea that you can adapt to solve what's in front of you. You don't have to stay in a lane and only use the tools that someone else handed you, but you can actually keep creating and innovating in that space.
That's really well said, Micah. And Scott, I think you know, Micah and I, we've known each other since we were kids. We both grew up at the same school and then went on to college together. And Mike, I remember when we were leading outdoor trips for Princeton Outdoor Action. And I think what you just said also applies to the whole range of being able to introduce people at the very beginning of potentially their experience in the outdoors to that whole extreme climbing world. You can really go the whole range. I think that's also something that's really such a gift that you have.
I think you're spot on, Barbara. And I think that's why the outdoors are so intoxicating to people and why it's so important to expose more and more people to that, because even a little glimmer of it and, you know, the self-development that can come out of it, the confidence, the audacity paired with practicality, all those things are pretty amazing gifts. And, you know, you can, as you said, it can be someone's first experience, or it can be the thing that is their bread and butter, or it's the thing that they make their living on, but it always is going to give them all those things.
I really love that expression, audacity paired with practicality. I think that's a lot of what you do and a lot of what Legato is. I had the pleasure to meet your team in Mozambique. And I think there's some great news that I just saw recently about the government itself naming the mountain there. Can you share that story with us?
Yeah, so it's really fun. Mozambique has just done a huge lift on identifying key biodiversity areas inside of Mozambique and Namuli, which had been identified as a KBA, a key biodiversity area, KBA. Before that, through the Critical Ecosystems Partnership Fund and the KBA movement was again like affirmed in that stature through the work that was done by the Mozambican government. And it's wonderful because we wanted to make it a national treasure, and we are so much closer to doing that now. And that's really been an incredible journey for us. And to not only have it be in international news through the launch of our film that came out in 2016, but also now, in the national news in Mozambique, and continuing to build on that momentum to create what we hope will happen in the next couple of years, which will be one of Mozambique's newest community conservation areas on Mount Namuli.
Such an achievement. And also, it's one of those things you just, because you've been so vested in the community there, you can just see the way in which that will absolutely change what is this land, this landscape, in what is otherwise a little bit of a fraught mining and some real unrest. So cheers to you and your team for being part of documenting the why we need to set land aside in those areas like that. Amazing.
Yeah, it is. It is really amazing. And it's interesting, Barbara, because in some ways it also speaks to a bit of a tension that we have, because I love that news and I want it to go side by side with news about the 12,000 people who live on Mount Namuli and call it their home and like what they are doing for their lives, right? And it's this thing. So at Legato, we work so hard to say we're not a conservation organization, we're not a development organization, we are a thriving futures organization. And yet when we're working in areas of high biodiversity importance around the world, so of course we're celebrating the biodiversity win, but I am so curious when we can talk about those things in a more nuanced way, right? Like, how do we drive toward that? Because it ultimately, until all of those things are paired, then we're probably not achieving thriving futures, right? If we can sector them off and say, you know, here is this achievement. I want to see the larger backstory. I want to see the fuller picture. I don't want to just see the mountain in the photo.
Fascinating. And really, at some level, the fault of the environmental story, the narrative, which has really left things so siloed, which doesn't paint the full picture and often leaves communities behind. And that is not at all your message. So I can understand how that sort of news is bittersweet, because as it's reported, it's quite traditional.
Yeah. And again, like, I don't, get me wrong, I'll take the win. That's a great thing for Namuli. And, you know, my challenge to myself and to all of us is say, how can we expand our view on this? How can we expand our view on how we're telling these stories so that we're not, again, contributing to this isolation and this constant effect of, you know, here's the conservation lane and here's what else is happening. But those things, like, ne'er the two shall meet. And what, you know, kind of tying in what we've been talking about thus far, when I started working on Mount Namuli. I mean, I went there first in 2011, actually, to do a reconnaissance trip to see if I could pull off giving scientists vertical access to find potentially new species, to actually be able to get the vertical access. So if the climbing was possible, the science was possible. And most importantly, if the local community members wanted us to be there, if that was going to be valid. And all those things checked out. And when I came back in 2014 to launch Legato with a month-long expedition where we found new species to science, where we put up a first ascent, where we partnered with a local Mozambican nonprofit called Lupa that specializes in biodiversity protection and land rights, we did all of that. But what happened is that the place that it was most comfortable for me to act on all of those levels was to then slide into this conservation organization. And that's what I thought Legato had to be. And I spent quite a bit of time in that space before I realized, like, oh, this doesn't fit, right? Like, this is too limiting. This doesn't track with all the ways that I have created a career, the way I create teams, the way I solve problems. And it was being able to say, I don't choose to be limited in this way, but I choose instead to be innovative. And our team chooses instead to look at what we're dealing with in front of us and say, how do we work with local people to protect this landscape? The way we do it is by meeting their needs. And the way we do it is by working across priorities, not in single sectors. And that, you know, that's exactly what we've been talking about so far in this conversation, because it's that adaptability. And sometimes I think early on in my career, I used to think, God, I wish I was a professional conservationist, right? Like, I wish I'd worked for Conservation International, or I'd been like, you know, I'd like gotten an internship there when I was at Princeton, and then this was my career. And now I think, gosh, probably the reason that I created Legato is because I never had that background. Because I didn't have to break out of that background. I only had to stop and say, what do I know and what does my team know that needs to be done? And can we solve for that and not define ourselves with someone else's terms and make this thing have legs and have traction?
You know, I think that's such an important insight and observation, and really a source of, you know, inspiration, because it is tempting to try and, you know, to just accept the boxes that are put out there for, you know, what you should do and how you should do it. But when you get on the ground and when you have, you know, incredible opportunities where you can go to some of these places and you can interact and see for yourself what's going on, you find out that you need some good conservation biologists, no doubt. The science is incredibly important. But the science alone isn't enough to move from an unsustainable dynamic to one that's more sustainable and more grounded in, say, you know, certain environmental values. And every place tends to present different types of issues and complexities in their own way. And sometimes you need an anthropologist. Sometimes you need a lawyer. Sometimes you need an engineer. Most of the time, you need some combination of all these different disciplines blended in a way that, regardless of what's, you know, technically going on, is compelling and is communicable to, you know, a vast array of stakeholders. So I really like how you've kind of stepped away from so many of these labels and assumptions and said, you know, no, we're just going to focus on what's there. But so that makes me want to ask, you know, Micah, when you say thriving futures, what exactly do you mean by that?
Yeah, thriving futures is our term for when thriving people are living in thriving places. And it became really important for us to have that as a target. And the reason that it's a future and not a present state is because we're building together towards this collective action. And what Legato really sees ourselves as is a bit of a catalyst to get to that future and to hold the space for local and Indigenous peoples and the organizations that are working with them to move to a thriving future. So that's our desired state. And then we have a whole host of ways that we get there. But again, it's a thriving future. It's not a thriving section.
And can you give us a little overview, the landscape on the places you've chosen to work so far?
Yeah, definitely. So we started in Mount Namuli in Mozambique, and now we are working in northern Kenya in the Matthews Range with the Naminak Community Conservancy. And we are also going to be working in Botswana, and that will start happening later on this year. So we are actively working in Kenya and Mozambique, and we're about to start working in Botswana. And then we are examining a couple potential partnerships in Latin America.
Fantastic. And I'm wondering, you know, if we could kind of unpack this a little bit more, because I think Legato's approach is so distinctive And it resonates a lot with at Lookfar when we partner with, you know, local groups, very similar to the approach we take. So when you got your start, you know, I think you had just a small little bit of money and then, you know, just kind of a vision. Maybe if you could kind of walk us through, you know, what that looked like in the beginning and then how you worked kind of at that applied level and then how it's evolved.
Yeah. A little bit of money is a generous way to put it, Scott. I appreciate that. So when we started, we had $11,000 and that was raised entirely from the outdoor industry. So Patagonia, Osprey Pax, and the Petzl Foundation supported our initial work. And what we did was we then leveraged that and got funding from conservation groups because we were able to put Mount Namuli quite a bit more on the global conservation map. And that was really important. But because of that, like I was saying, we tended to see only conservation as the solution. But the reality was that we were working, you know, when we started working on Mount Namuli, one of my favorite things to share with people is that the local government and national government thought that 3,000 people lived on this mountain. 12,000 people live on this mountain. So imagine that amount of an error when you think about what are the social services already somewhat limited in that part of Mozambique. What does it look like to have healthcare? What does it look like to have education support? What does it look like to have any of those pieces in a remote mountain area that's the access is continuously washed out. So for us, to be the single social change organization driving towards a conservation agenda, that's a pretty fraught place to be, but that was the place I was in, right? And so, you know, you're working with local people and, what you're trying to solve for is like 10th on their priority list. And yet it's the only thing that you're willing to play ball on. Explaining this out loud is almost terrifyingly embarrassing to say, because I think, how did I think that was going to be possible, right? Like, no, that can't work. And I would argue so many people, organizations, giant organizations still operate on that level. And part of it is that because we've been taught that it's scary to have mission drift. We've been taught that it's scary to get people's expectations up. We've been taught that it's scary to be human. We've been taught that conservation started with, you know, austere scientists who just want to go prove data. And therefore, we all have fallen in line with more of a non-human way to relate. But ultimately, what we're doing is relating human to human. And sure, there are examples of, you know, incredible biodiversity reserves that are untouched by any humans. And great, all the power to that. But most of the biodiversity that we have a responsibility as a globe to protect, most of the ways that we need to mitigate for this incredible climate change that we're dealing with is about working with local and indigenous people. So what we need to do is then meet their priorities, which that's a pretty huge cliff to step off of. And for us, we stepped off of it very gradually because we didn't have the funding to step off of it entirely. We knew that that was how to get to success, but we didn't have the right concert of funders who were in our pockets to get there. And so one of the things is that the way that we've then developed Legato as we move forward is to start from the beginning with Thriving Futures, not to retroactively fit towards that, but to begin in our program with Kenya, to begin in our program with Botswana, working with communities about what their legacy is. That's what Legato means in Portuguese and Spanish. And it's fundamental to our work because it's this jaw-dropping, eyes wide open moment of like, wow, I have a legacy and I can create my legacy every day. And here is what I want to create in my life and for the people to come after me. And that's a really fast way to get to a concept of thriving futures. And so now, like I said, as we're moving into these new partnerships, we're doing things really differently than we did on Namuli, because on Namuli, we started with $11,000 and we had a much less linear path, is I guess probably the gentlest way to put it.
So much of life though is not linear, is it?
Exactly. Not at all. But it teaches you tons. And I think like that's part of the humility is to say, hey, yeah, that's never going to line up the way we're working to line things up in these other places. And, you know, I joke sometimes that on Namuli, we went from F to A to Z to P. And, you know, I mean, like that was the dance step and it continues to be the dance step. But it's acknowledging that and then growing from it and saying, through that, it also made us see, hey, if we had actually done you know, step A at A time, as opposed to between M and N, like this would have rolled out really differently, right? And like, so now let's correct and let's move forward and try it that way, but always be in that space of like iterating and learning. And I think that's what's like so critical to it.
So critical.
What I really appreciate about that is how much, you know, results are important. Sometimes maybe in a more academic setting, it's, did you follow the rules? What was your process? What was your methodology? But at the end of the day, and I think this always becomes really clear if you're on the ground and you're in the presence of, say, Indigenous communities, you either are going to, you know, help or not. You're either going to move toward thriving futures or you're not. And if you don't, it doesn't matter what you did. It's wrong. It's not right. Clinging to, you know, some sort of notion, whether it's a brilliant notion or not, that doesn't produce results, you know, I just don't think, you know, kind of cuts the mustard. And it reminds me of something Steve Martin said about how to be an art collector. He's like, you know, you don't need to go to art museums. You don't need to study art history. Just buy a painting and then try and sell it. And that'll teach you everything you need to know about the art world. And I kind of feel like this is too superficial a shorthand, obviously, but that your experience is a great model for how to maintain focus on results and a very open mind in terms of whichever paths are needed, you know, to get to those results. And even frankly, it's even more dynamic because the results themselves aren't always totally clear, but you just kind of know you have to move toward, you know, something that would be impactful.
Well, and results are so, it's such a funny term to head right at what is a pretty contentious subject, which is, I mean, I know that when you're saying results, Scott, that you and I think alike. Result means that someone who lives in this place that has incredible biocultural value is saying, my life is better. And I have water for my family that I can count on for longer, that I have a forest canopy, right? It's their result. The result is not, there's been this many hectares that have been preserved. But what happens is that we all march to these impact metrics, which I am not saying they're not worthy, but what I'm saying is that they are so much more nuanced than that. Because you can say that this many hectares were preserved, but you didn't move the needle at all for the people who are living inside of them. Is that a result, right? Is that you can, it's the same thing with SDGs. And if are you meeting these targets? But then if you talk to local people, is your life better? Their concept of what makes their life better doesn't line up with the SDGs all the time, right? So that's like, how do we start talking about that differently? How do we start talking about what it means to have work like this be sustainable means that it's locally led and locally owned and can be resilient in a way that it can withstand different forces of our world and of nature and come out the other side with local and Indigenous communities still moving forward. Like that's the result that I'm most interested in. And yes, I can play on the field of here are biodiversity results, here are, you know, development results, but it's that other piece that I think we need to bring into the conversation and stop being wary of and instead really embrace and talk about like, what does collective action results look like? What do you hope, you know, what do hope and trust and agency look like when they're increased? And then how do we prove that those things fulfill on the other big targets? Because I think we've gone too far in the other direction. And I'm really curious, and I actually think it is going to change in what I'll call the thriving future sector, which we will right now say is a growing sector of social impact. In the thriving future sector, I think that's going to be part of it.
I just joined, so I can attest that it is growing. Yeah.
Nice.
I'm in for thriving futures. And Micah, what you just said about resilience is important. I think about this all the time because enduring is really important given what we know about our climate futures. So putting thriving future out there is so interesting. We already know that climate impacts are being felt in these communities, right? And rhythms are changing that have been traditional and folks have been able to count on it for planting and crops. I mean, the very environmental backdrop is switching before a lot of eyes. And I think that this notion of being able to increase agency so that inherent wisdom, the inherent understanding of very complex places is represented by the people who know best, who've been stewarding and living on that land, is such an important part of our collective thriving future. You know, thriving futures there, but also collectively, including those voices, those ways of knowing.
Yeah. I think that's such a good point. And it's, if we don't account for that, and it's not, accounting isn't the right word, like scratch that, take two. It's if we don't lead with that, that's when we're running into trouble. And I think that it's, again, it goes back to being human and being humble. I was laughing in a meeting I had the other day. I've recently started talking about like bringing soft skills to conservation. I don't know if you remember this, Barbara, but when we were in college, Rick Curtis, who ran the Princeton Outdoor Action, he had this thing, when you became a leader, you had to start having a leader radar. And Rick would put his hand on his head like a giant satellite and be like, beep, 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 and turn his head around. And to this day, like telling that story, it makes me like uncomfortable because I would feel uncomfortable for him when he would do that, right? I now think about that. It's like, what is your radar on? And if you're like, you know, what a great background in outdoor ed to be able to then run this stuff where you have to be able to check in.
And it really makes me think about how you communicate all of this, because metrics just aren't enough. And metrics don't often, you know, work, you know, in a lot of these communities. They might work with the donors, but will be entirely unpersuasive. And similarly, although the metrics are ever present, they're not going anywhere, they do have some value. There's always something more that I think needs to be conveyed rather than just populating a dashboard and, you know, moving toward green or whatever the, however it's color coded. And that brings to mind, you know, so LookFar has, since its inception, worked closely with a Dutch charitable foundation called DOB Ecology. And like a lot of, like any foundation, really, you know, there's always a need for, you know, what are the metrics? What are the milestones? What are we measuring in order to determine what's going on? But something that we've always tried to emphasize is there's an important role for, lack of a better term, storytelling. That there's a creative and kind of an artistic side that needs to be nourished every bit as much as kind of the technical and quantitative side. If you're going to paint a picture that can capture some of the dynamism that's going on. Because for one thing, even if successful, that success isn't necessarily permanent. And in fact, almost assuredly isn't. But if you can blend, you know, science, data, tech, and then art, really, for photos, writing, film, books, you know, even podcasts, it can help kind of connect all of the disparate elements. And while there's still no substance for being there, can get you awfully close when you have all this together. And I wonder, you know, given your sort of multifaceted background, how much you draw on that to try and convey, you know, what Legato is doing and why your work is so important, whether you're talking to funders or locals or whatever.
Yeah, we early on for Legato, that was paramount with the film that we released Namuli. We've done a bunch of other short films, and we're just about to have a woman named Roshni Lodia go to Mozambique and then to Kenya with us, which we're super excited about. And she's going to help us tell some of these legacy stories. Because what happened is, while we were in the incubation chamber for the past, you know, year and a half, and saying, hey, we're really going to take this model and it has legs and we're going to start expanding, we realized that we didn't have the right stories for the way that we're working with Thriving Futures. And that, to your point, that that's so important. And it's not only important to share with the world and to share with funders, but it's important to share back to the communities that we're working in. So, you know, we're doing these series of legacy stories and Thriving Futures stories that we're doing with some of our friends and colleagues on Mount Namuli. And, you know, the first place to show those is to them on Mount Namuli to say, hey, here's what this looks like. And here's what we're talking about and how it can also help us all think about, you know, how we publicly share our legacies and how we stand behind them and how they, you know, create a collective legacy and then collective action. So I'm really excited about this next phase of storytelling for Legato. I think it's going to be really helpful. And it's been hard to be patient for that because we wanted to do that for the past year and a half. And because of COVID, we haven't had the ability to go and actually capture those stories. So I'm looking forward to being able to do that.
Yeah, definitely. I'm excited to see it. And I wonder if we could pivot a little bit, because your book, you know, Vertical Ethiopia, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that, because I, you know, I'm thinking about the kinds of folks that have been tuning in, who often have a lot of interest and ambition in whether it's conservation or whatnot or writing, but, you know, kind of like you said, often think, well, but I'm not a writer, so maybe I shouldn't be writing a book. But I'm wondering, you know, what catalyzed that I'm going to write a book about this and kind of the story behind that?
The honest story is that, well, so I was writing pretty seriously. I was freelancing for lots of magazines and traveling around the world on assignment. It was great. And decided that I also wanted to get an MFA in fiction. So I was in the midst of doing that work, and I got a free cup of coffee in Boulder, Colorado. And I got a free cup of coffee from a company called Novo. And I overheard the owners talking about a trip they were taking to Ethiopia. And it sounded like an awesome trip. And they were trying to find the genetic origins of a rare coffee called geisha coffee, which was being grown in Panama, but it all things in the coffee world and the way that all coffee arabica originated in Ethiopia means that you should be able to find its origins in Ethiopia. And wouldn't that be an amazing story and also a huge thing economically? Because at that time, I think geisha was getting $150 a pound. So, you know, you find the source of that in Ethiopia and what that can do to the economic engine of the coffee world in Ethiopia, it seemed like a slam dunk. It was. I was able to pitch the story, go to Ethiopia on this trip, but we didn't find the coffee and the trip wasn't quite what I had in mind. And I had a lot of downtime and I spent a lot of time as someone who'd run trips myself all over the world, being a silent participant, which I've learned, and Barbara would not be surprised to know this, that I suck at that. Because I like to be in the front and I like to, or at least I like to be on things that are well executed. And suddenly I was on kind of an amalgamated, very long drive every day. And I thought I could be doing something different. And I found pictures of these beautiful sandstone towers up in northern Ethiopia. And I thought that's where I should be. Yeah, the coffee world's nice and all, but I'm going north. And at that point, I met an Ethiopian publisher. And they knew that I was a writer. And they said, hey, would you write a book about this expedition? Because, you know, you have the background as a writer, you have the status as a climber, and a professional climber in the US, and people know you internationally, and it would really help if it could put Ethiopia on the map. And so I said yes. So I went and wrote a book about climbing in northern Ethiopia, which is especially poignant right now given what's going on in the Tigray region. And I read the news about what's happening there every day and am just heartbroken by what's happening and reading about towns and cities that I know really well. And I got to write a book that, as it turned out, the climbing wasn't that great. but the climbing was, it was beautiful and it was super inspiring, but it was also really scary. And the book is really about how to think of Ethiopia about as a place of adventure and opportunity instead of drought and famine and poverty. And at that point in time, it was really critical because Ethiopia was stepping out of a legacy of drought and famine and poverty. And it was, you know, everyone's favorite trifecta to assign it. And, you know, through writing that book, and I did a 50-city speaking tour with it, you know, what interested me the most was kind of pulling at the ear of our collective consciousness and saying, that's not a fair way to think of an entire country and, you know, a nation's people. Like, we need to be more expansive. We need to be able to, again, you know, be more human in this. We need to understand that there's a heck of a lot more nuance. And so that's what that book was about. But it's a beautiful book. Gabe Rogel shot the photos for it. And it's a series of vignettes about climbing and exploring in northern Ethiopia.
So true. And so true about the importance of story, because I don't know if you all have had this experience, but you might be traveling somewhere and you get a call, text, or email from your parents on another part of the world, and they've heard about some natural disaster that has nothing to do with where you happen to be in the country, but they suddenly feel like everyone in that country must be experiencing this thing. And you realize, not at all. You know, there's so many lives, and as you point out, Micah, so many ways of being in any one context. And this notion that the headlines are all we know about certain places in the world, it's time we got a little deeper. It's time, I think, that we also broadened the voices that tell those stories. I love that about Legato, Micah. And I love that you're having the stories being reflected back to community, and also that you're letting community members share the stories. I mean, that's vital.
Yeah. No, my dad texts me, or I get every inflammatory news clipping about Mozambique that happens internationally sent to me with no preamble, usually early in the morning. So, and I'm always like, yes, I know, and this is happening, and here's where we are, and here's a, you know, here's a different story. But yeah, I mean, it's amazing. And frankly, you know, right now we are predominantly Africa-based, although we're looking at working in Latin America, and the U.S. in particular is not that great about Africa stories, right? Like, I love being in the rest of the world and watching the news, and there's a lot more going on. It's really different, and it's pretty shocking to me. And I really look forward to that changing. And I know that I'm part of that. I mean, that's part, I mean, whatever, the two films that I've made and the two books that I've written have been about Africa. But to your point, Barbara, there's, you know, I mean, I'm a white woman who grew up in Minnesota, right? So like, I'm really excited to, you know, help support and make space for, you know, stories that aren't being told by me. But that was my way to find, that was how I found my way to then doing this work at the same time.
It's brilliant. And I love that it was all fueled by a cup of coffee and from there many things. And it was probably a really good cup of coffee. Hey, Micah, I want to ask you something on a very different realm, but I think so integral to all of the work you do, which is you're a phenomenal career woman and you're a fantastic mother. And I want to hear the story about how and whether having children has affected your outlook and also shaped your worldview in the work that you do.
Well, speaking to another mom, I think, yeah, having children has completely changed my world outlook. But you know, that's why I wanted to have kids. This sounds really odd. Before I had children, I thought, God, it'd be really cool to be pregnant. Like, it'd be really cool to have your body do that thing, right? Like, well, that looks like a neat human experience that I have access to as a woman. And then I also thought, I think I might understand the world better if I'm a parent. And holy my, was I right. I think there are lots of ways that we can be in this world and you can access knowledge, not as a parent, a biological parent, a step parent, you name it. But for me, it just made me feel so much more in the middle of it and had so much more compassion and changed my way of understanding other women, especially, and other women around the world. And I felt like I'd had the experience as a single woman. I'd had the experience as a married woman. I'd had the experience as like not having kids. Like, I know what that means. I know what it was like to be in my late 30s and have not made that choice. I don't know what it's like to be in my 50s and my 60s and beyond. But now I can have the experience of what it is to be a mom. And it's like rapid acceleration into humanity is what parenthood is, and all the humbling that comes with it. And I think that for me, it didn't shift like what I'm doing. Legato was headed where we're headed for a long time. But I think that it made the importance of it heightened. It made me say, like, imagine if your choice was between cutting down an old growth tree and feeding your family. Why should you have to make that choice? Now, I could say that in a really esoterical way, but I know what it means to feed my family. And I know with damn certainty that if I lived on the edge of a highland rainforest and I had to cut that tree down to feed my family, that I'd be there cutting that tree, right? And I can say that with a conviction that's so different as a mom and that like fierce mama bear instinct that I have about protecting my family no matter what. And when they are in crisis, like grabbing and clawing my way to any sort of solution. And I think that that is the part of it that you carry forward and you say, okay, like we're in this together, right? And you can pretend, I think before I had children, I pretended that I wasn't part of the together. And I now get so fundamentally that I'm part of the together.
So interesting. And all of us on this call are parents. I mean, we certainly are vested in the future, you know, vested in that thriving, but it's beautiful.
Absolutely. So friends, I think we should start to wind down. It's not fair because Mike has done so many awesome things. We could probably do a multi-volume series, but frankly, I'm just pleased that she's sat still long enough to talk to us because it sounds like you always have a lot of
I went climbing earlier today,
on.
Just in my
Yeah, I was not surprised. And so the way we kind of like to wrap up, although I will reserve some time for tales from the Princeton Outdoor Club at the very end, if you want to indulge, is to ask each guest three questions. And they're fairly broad in scope, but meant to be answered in the specific context of your work, if that's possible. And no need to expound on and on, just sort of what comes to mind and you know, share that thought. And our first question is, what gives you hope?
What gives me hope today is to see so many people caring and acting and speaking up about whatever it is they need to care and act and speak up for. I'm blown away by it, and I am riding that wave and am really excited to see where it brings us all.
The second question is, if you could look ahead 10 years into the future, you know, what's something, I'm sure there are many things, but what's something in particular that comes to mind that you'd really like to see? And I want to qualify this by saying that I have gotten more feedback on the 10-year period than on any other thing we've done on the podcast. I got the question, why 10 years, Scott? Why not 20? I think it's perfectly acceptable. And while I get that there might be some optimal number of years out there, I'm just going to stick with 10 because why not? But in any event, I do hear everyone. But so Micah, so 10 years from now or some other time, if you would feel more comfortable, what would be something you'd like to see?
I'd like to see thriving futures as a full-on sector, as a movement that has taken off, that has a, yeah, that like we're well into the groundswell of thriving futures with other organizations, with other people, with, you know, kind of riding the forefront of that into 10 years in the future and having it be strong.
Last question is, how can people help?
Well, you can join the Thriving Futures movement, see, like Scott just did. But all joking aside, we actually are putting a coalition together right now of organizations who are acting in a similar way. So, you know, driven by locally defined priorities and supporting them across the Thriving Future sector. So not seeing it as two lanes that you're moving on. That doesn't count. It has to be, it has to be locally driven and meeting those needs. So we are looking for other organizations that are already working in that space or want to make a shift into that space and then creating a coalition. And I'm happy to speak with anyone about what that looks like. It's in really early stages, but I think it's going to be critical to push this forward and to not only result in a deeper understanding, but also kind of a funding landscape. The other way that people can help is to go and, you know, visit our website, share our stories, contribute, bring your family, your friends, whomever it is, and help support the movement as we go forward.
I'm such a huge fan, just such a huge fan, Micah. And I couldn't agree more that Legato is pointing the direction of this integrated, holistic way that we're seeing more and more organizations striving to become. And Pathfinder Where I Am is one of them, but I'm just seeing the groundswell start. I think Decade of Thriving Futures is, you're just ahead of the curve. It really is the direction that we're being asked to leave behind some of the structure, some of the rigidity, and move in this direction of being locally driven. I'm delighted.
And what I think is so cool about it and about the idea behind this whole coalition is that, okay, right now it's happening, you know, all these people are kind of bubbling toward it, but what if we can, you know, do it in a more accelerated way? What if we can crack the nut of how we do the monitoring and evaluation of this? How do you measure collective action inside of this space in a way that like we can all agree and start using those terms so that we can build this faster, smarter, better funded, right? Because that's how you start driving all of those changes. So I'm really fired up about that work. I really more and more at our team, we're seeing like, hey, yeah, we're working in Mozambique and Kenya, Botswana, and then we have the coalition. And it's equally as big of a deal for, I think, what Legato is going to create in the next 10 years.
It's lovely and essential to create that field.
Yeah, totally. And I'll say, Micah, you know, LookFar is sort of unbalanced in that we have a much greater presence and work and partners in Latin America than in Africa. And you know, you've done wonderful work in Africa, and I know are exploring Latin America. And I, you know, we'd love to explore, you know, at LookFar, you know, ways to maybe collaborate and if only just to learn more from you, because there's I think such a, you know, a symbiosis with what we have tried to do, our approach, but there's some important, you know, distinctions too. And I think we could learn a lot. So, and Pathfinder too, Barbara, we should all get together in person and talk further about all this.
I've joined the movement, Scott, with you guys for sure.
All right. So last thing is, you guys are college buddies, Princeton Outdoor Club. What's the real deal? What's going on there?
It's an amazing network. I don't know. I mean, it was foundational to my sanity in life, that's for sure. I mean, how about you, Barbara?
So wonderful too. So Scott, the real story is we were all asked to be these leaders leading as older classmates, basically freshmen as they're coming in. So they're called frosh trips. And what's so interesting about it is that you think it's about outdoor skills and you have to have all that wilderness first aid. You have to be completely across that. But what you're really doing is helping people come from all different backgrounds and backdrops of life and all their jitters of entering university. That's the radar. You're just really group dynamics is 101, Micah. I mean, didn't you find that?
Yeah. And that's what it goes back to, right? Like in life, group dynamics are where you're going to make it or break it, right? Like, I mean, that's being a mom, right? That's running a family. That's being a leader in all these different ways, a leader of yourself, you name it. And sometimes I think back to that time and I'm like, yep, those are those skills.
The radar, Scott, which is something you are so good at. Every single time I feel you welcome people onto your podcast, you create a dynamic of genuine curiosity and learning. And no matter where someone comes from, where their backdrop is, I feel like you just create that space of welcome. It's awesome.
Well, that's been the goal, you know, to learn and to share. And I think we've done a whole lot of that today. You know, Barbara, as always, you know, I hope you'll come back and do this again with me. It's great to team up. And Micah, I mean, what can I say? You're awesome. And, you know, really just looking forward to seeing what else you're doing and to, you know, maybe finding ways to collaborate down the line. And otherwise, you know, just be great to keep in touch.
Yeah, no, I'm looking forward to another conversation soon in a non-podcast format about what some of that can look like, Scott and Barbara, to all connecting with you again. So thanks for having me today. That was really fun.
Such a pleasure.
Thanks, everybody.
LookFar is a U.S. 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to defending wild and wondrous places and working with the people living in and among them. More at lookfar.org.